In the shadow of Capitol Hill and with a view of the U.S. Supreme Court building sits the Folger Shakespeare Library, which holds the world's largest collection of printed works of Shakespeare. Of 233 known surviving copies of the first folio, published in 1623, the Folger owns a remarkable 82. That is rather like a single city bank having assets in the trillions. Now, why bring up Shakespeare and the Folger at the STM conference here in Washington? Well, for at least two reasons. Washington is a city that respects and even worships power. The men and women who live here aspire to the ranks of the powerful, whether as lawmakers or lobbyists, presidents or pundits. Shakespeare, who died 400 years ago on April 23rd, his 52nd birthday, came by his power through the exercise of his mind and his pen. And that power has proven more enduring than any government has ever enjoyed. A room full of publishers should appreciate that. The other reason, and yes, it is related to the discussion of the release of the new STM Tech Trends 2020, is that I'm only too happy to seize the chance to quote a bit of the Bard, who, as ever, has something relevant to point to in his works. This is from Julius Caesar. The lines are for Brutus. "There is a tide in the affairs of men, which, taken at the flood, leads on to fortune. Omitted, all the voyage of their life is bound in shallows and in miseries. On such a full sea are we now afloat, and we must take the current when it serves, or lose our ventures." The deliberations of the STM Future Group last December have provided us with the memorable image of such a tide in the affairs of STM publishing. "On such a full sea are we now afloat." Borne along by the force of computer power and the explosive growth in information, there are powerful currents in this sea, as we have heard. And as Shakespeare said, we must take the current when it serves or lose our ventures. So to discuss those various currents, I want to introduce our panel very briefly. Sam Bruinsma. Sam, welcome. Sam is Senior Vice President of Business Development for Brill, based in Leiden, the Netherlands. He is the chair of STM's Future Lab Committee. To his left is Heather Ruland Staines. Heather, welcome. Heather is Director, Publisher, and Content Strategy at ProQuest. She works on the CIPIX course materials platform and discovery services, and Heather has a PhD in history from Yale University. To her left is Michael Forster. Michael, welcome. Michael is Managing Director for Publications at IEEE. He is previously was at John Wiley & Sons and held key management roles as vice president in Wiley's physical sciences and engineering, research innovations, and research publishing business. And lastly, at the very far end on the left from my side of things is Phil Jones. Phil, welcome. Phil is head of publisher outreach at Digital Science, a technology company working to make scientific research more efficient. It is operated by the global media company, the Holzbrinck Publishing Group. And Sam, I'd like to start with you because it seems as if people are interested in the process here, and I want to ask a little bit about the process, the discussion that you had in December. It must be a challenge each year. You've done this now four times. You are the chair. It must be a challenge to look at incredible explosion in technology and sort things out. And particularly interesting for you because at Brill, the emphasis of your publications is on the humanities and social sciences. So you're a bit of an outsider there. So you see things rather differently than other members in the discussion do. Tell us about that.
Well, there is a change, of course, between a purely science publisher and a humanities and social science publisher. Though I need to remind you that several of the larger publishers, like Wiley and Springer Nature, have large portfolios in social sciences and humanities as well. But there is a difference, and the difference is probably most because our authors, on the whole, are more like scholars than like scientists. And increasingly, they use all kinds of digital techniques and digital methods, but there is a difference. And the same do we see, of course, in publishing, in academic publishing. everything happens with the science publishers a few years ahead of what we are experiencing. But nevertheless, we are faced, and yet we are faced with the same circumstances, because the market shapes us as well. And so there is a difference, but what I, when I first came into this future lab, in this room in the Burlington House, I was actually expecting a lot of very young people with probably white coats or something, a lab, talking all kind of very techie talk, which I probably couldn't understand at all. But, well, that was not the case. And it was a very, as I said, diverse group of people. And many of the things that were put forward by other people, I could recognize as well as being applicable to our business as well.
Right. And Heather Staines, I suppose the interesting dynamic in that room must be the way ideas come together. People come in with some thoughts ahead of time, but then there's an impact of the discussion itself. And so an oxygen atom and a hydrogen atom combine to make water. This is the same kind of process, these atoms coming together and somehow creating new compounds you hadn't anticipated.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Usually a couple of months before the meeting is coming, I'll start to try to keep my eye out to try to grab some interesting tidbits to bring to the meeting, and there's a little bit of pressure there when you're up against these guys bringing things in. And it starts out very organized when you go around the room and you hope someone's not going to take your idea or you're going to have something left. And then very quickly it becomes chaos, as Aipka mentioned, and she does her best to kind of keep us on track. It amazes me every year when we see the infographic that it actually comes together and makes sense, because we are jumping around from idea to idea connection. There's lots of flip charts and flying and post-it notes and everything. It's pretty exciting. And then of course the conversation, continues, on into the evening. So I highly recommend it, if you haven't had a chance to attend.
Well, it sounds like a great opportunity to do a little pie in the sky thinking, but I would imagine that you have to pull it back down into the present situation at the same time.
You do, and sometimes when the ideas are going up on the board, you think, well, maybe that's something that doesn't have much to do with publishing at all. I mean, in fact, those are the interesting sort of tendrils that you go off, because you will be challenged. You want to put up information from adjacent industries, who we should be looking to in terms of authentication and data security, perhaps. And if someone challenges your idea as maybe being too far in left field, other folks will come in and say, no, I see this as the connection to publishing. If we are going to have new outputs, new visualization tools, as Beth presented on yesterday, publishers may be involved in making sure that the delivery and metrics and new things around those types of tools, continue to evolve alongside.
All right. Well, Michael Forster, I've already sort of delivered the full extent of my knowledge of chemistry by using the analogy of oxygen and hydrogen combining to make water there. I know that you've had some experience working in your previous position at Wiley with something called ChemPlanner, and that sort of brings us to the point around AI and big data. Talk about how important these AI-powered tools are going to be for the end user. It's really a critical moment in publishing, I think.
So, as an engineer by training, but a chemist by osmosis through 10 years working at Wiley, and at the risk of turning this into the chat show into a bit of paid programming, until I joined IEEE in November. As you said, I was most recently involved in a research innovations role at Wiley, and we launched a new product in the fall of last year, which resonates very clearly with the trends that have been drawn out here, in the sense of especially the combination of combining artificial intelligence and big data. Now, we can discuss the definitions of what constitutes either of those things. What is an AI, and how big is big data? But if I can give you an anecdotal version of the genesis of this product. It all starts with being researcher-centric, as we talked about yesterday, and focusing on what the actual needs of a researcher are, rather than creating additive experiences in their lives where information is abundant and time is scarce. And we also heard yesterday about how one of the biggest corporate fields of research intensity is the pharmaceutical industry. So in that industry, there are people whose jobs consist essentially of starting the process of creation of new drugs. And to do that, they draw on the whiteboard a target or candidate molecule, a new compound that eventually could become a new drug. And then they apply a process. The current state of the scientific research process is to combine their knowledge, scientific theory within their domain, organic chemistry synthesis in this instance, with the empirical information in that space that they draw from the literature or past experience. And they engage in an iterative process, some trial and error, a lot of trial and error actually, to make those whiteboarded target compounds so that they can move them on to the next process of the drug pipeline testing and so on. Now, we were able to create the combination of an AI that had been developed by a group in Canada that was essentially program where the machine, the computer, had been taught organic chemistry with a database, a highly curated, high-quality database, highly normalized, classified, empirical information that AI could work with to apply the rules of the road of that domain to take the leap forward from the empirical, known, reported information in the literature to how do I get to that unknown that's on the whiteboard that no one has seen before?
Right. And so it's rather like teaching Watson to play chess. There are rules, there's a board, there are pieces, and there's a structure to it. And that's critical. And in chemistry, that's very important. Chemical compounds form in very reliable ways everywhere in the universe.
There are certainly rules of the road as to how they can form. That's right. And if you can't, if actually we did use the analogy of Deep Blue, the previous application of AI to chess playing, exactly as you said, because you can apply computational horsepower to how those scientific theories or rules of the domain actually manifest in the real world. So that's a perfect analogy for what we were doing. But, you know, I wouldn't want to give anyone the impression that, you can come up with the right answer every time. Actually, I prefer to say that a good research chemist in this instance is perhaps going down 99 blind alleys for each success they have in synthesizing one of those target compounds. But with the aid of this sort of device, this sort of product, then maybe you can start with a top five of high confidence options, and then maybe you only have to go down four blind alleys before hitting success and being able to put another candidate into the pipeline. And that, of course, you know, is a force multiplier. In that example of times 20. So maybe you can actually put 20 times more drugs into the pipeline. Each person can do 20 times more work in the same time. Choose your own example of how you apply it.
Right. And what we're hearing there is obviously the great potential in all of this, but also the challenge in it. And Phil Jones, you've been a research scientist. You know a bit about what it's like to work through these problems. And one of them is not simply that data, and this is why I've sort of raised the issue with Michael about chemistry. The data there is more or less structured. A lot of big data is unstructured. And the great example of that we've recently heard about is the so-called Panama Papers, this collaborative effort of journalists who suddenly were given something like 11 million single works, and they had to sort of sort out what this was going to tell them later. They had to go through the data. Some of it was organized, but a lot of it was like the kinds of things that are in your files in your office. And so this really is the problem here. It's not simply that data sort of is easily parsed, but that there's a real challenge in getting it to even hold to any form itself.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. To my mind, when we talk about big data, we're generally referring to these kind of large collaborative projects. Think GenBank, you know, and some of the other stuff that's involved in, say, you know, geology research or astronomy research and that sort of thing. And as a general rule, those kinds of data sets tend to be structured. So everybody who's all around the world who's doing that kind of research is using similar kinds of machines, doing similar kinds of outputs, and then they are depositing it in a centralized subject-specific repository that serves the purpose of creating this big sort of Uber data set, if you like. But on the other side of that, given the way that the current mandates and things are moving, researchers are being required to deposit their data irrespective of whether it conforms to one of these structures or not. So I think it's just worth keeping in mind that a lot of people are doing new work, they're doing using new techniques and doing completely new ideas, and some of their data could be of pretty much any form. And so it's important to make sure that all of those people have a place to put their data as well. And we also have to think very carefully about how we can make that sort of data discoverable, and how we can make sure that that's communicated effectively and gone to the sorts of people. Because that's more of a challenge. It's harder to do.
Right. So these mandates sound simple on the face of it. Yeah. You've got to make that data available, and it has to be shareable. But so doing doesn't really even address the challenge further on down the path.
Yeah, it partially addresses it. I mean, meeting the mandate is fairly simple, right? It's fairly easy. All you need is a repository, or you put it in supplementary information, and you just kind of, you know, put it in the filing cabinet, in the locked filing cabinet in the basement with a sign on it saying "Beware of the leopard." That doesn't solve the complete problem. It perhaps archives it and makes it available should somebody really want to find it, but it doesn't solve all of the issue of enabling an interested researcher who doesn't necessarily know that that piece of information exists, of enabling them to find it more easily. Yeah, so I think that's absolutely true.
Right. Sam Bruinsma, to sort of follow this point about structured and unstructured data, because I'm fascinated by this idea that big data sort of seems on the face of it to be a single thing, but as we look into it, it's hardly that at all. And in your world, the world of art history or archaeology or anything like that, the data does reveal things. It reveals patterns and certainly is helpful to these scholars, as you pointed out, in a way that's very different from the scientists who are looking for reproducible results.
Well, I'm not sure it's very different, but it is different, I think. Brill is involved. I'll give you an example. Brill is involved in a large project aimed at developing handwriting recognition software to bring that to the next generation, to the next level. And this software is being used to decipher 16th, 17th, 18th century handwritings in all kind of languages, all kind of Roman languages, I have to say. And what they use for this project are very large data sets, which are also not structured, maybe partially structured. And they actually don't know what they will find in there. Because no one has ever been able to read all that stuff. And that's everywhere in archives, in all our national libraries, etc. So that's an example of exploring large data sets in the humanities.
Interesting. Well, I guess for the last word on big data, there's a British economist who said, if you torture the data long enough, it'll tell you almost anything.
Yes.
Indeed. Well, we'll be torturing data. I don't want to torture that discussion too much further. I'd like to move on to another one of these particular currents that we've identified here, which is the one around data privacy and the web of trust. And I guess, Heather Staines, I have to ask you about web of trust, whether that's sort of a contradiction in terms at this point for many people. Do people feel that there is any trust left in the system there?
I think there's a lot of cynicism, you know, these days, and you know, you have the my sons are 13 and 15, and they sort of feel like they're, you know, there's no such thing as privacy. Of course, they have it's a limit to what they need to protect at 15 and 13. You know, one would hope. Certainly, as publishers that are trying to build services, as we talked about yesterday, you know, based upon you know predicting what might be useful to an author or useful to a researcher, we need to be able to gather and track information. And I know we're going to be hearing you know a lot about that in the next session. You know, but there's the integrity of the content, and then there's also the you balance that with the privacy of the user, and then there are workflow issues around the same thing. And it's really hard to kind of separate out, you know, you often have different teams, you know, kind of working to solve these problems. The tech team knows, you know, what is possible in terms of privacy and data security, but it's completely unworkable from the user experience team. And then, of course, you know, in an acquisition standpoint, you want to learn, you know, what you can from the user behavior as well as information about your authors. And it's just a really tough trade-off.
Right. Yeah,
I'd love to, you know, dig deeper into that.
Yeah. Well, for publishers, that it really is a challenge. They could see the potential, but they can't get to it, I guess is what you're saying there, when it comes to collecting that kind of data because of restrictions that have been imposed or the habits that are ingrained in institutions.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's problematic from the standpoint, I mean, we all, to a certain degree, manage our Facebook profiles and our LinkedIn profiles and, you know, what you can see and what you can't see. And, you know, even, you know, at that kind of higher level, you know, it is a time thing. It's that it's an additive thing. Who's got that much time on their hands? But if we're going to move into a space where we need to communicate to the end users the need for them to manage their metadata, the need for them to undertake reputation management, that is a time on the publisher side that needs to be spent in order to get them to agree, and perhaps only a certain number of them even ever get to it. So do you have opt-in? Do you have opt-out? You've got different standards for different regions of the world, different standards based on the age of the folks who are in the database. So, I mean, it's got... It's like an onion when you start to go into that.
Michael Forster, this really then, as Heather just alluded to, is a challenge to the publishers to begin to work with their customers to address it, because there's benefits on both sides, I think you feel. Talk about that, but then also talk about the sort of unintended consequence of a lot of this. It leads to something which is rather dire for publishers.
Well, I think the direness that I might encounter immediately is that... I might, in our analogy here, suffer the bends as I sort of float up from layer four to right to the top at layer one, because you know, I think where we're joining dots here is in and you know I'm very much a sort of product guy, so I can make this connection between the individual user and these questions of how much privacy they are able to or want to maintain in interacting with information services and products, and what those products are able to do with them. So, you know, the technology trends that we've been talking about here hold enormous promise in terms of, to take a sort of consumer world example, doing for your information needs as a researcher what Netflix can do for you as an entertainment consumer. You can deploy collaborative filtering technologies, algorithms that learn from your consumption behavior, that identify and make connections between the motifs in your behavior and other people, and say, you know, other people like you like these sorts of things, and you haven't seen this, so why don't you try watching this TV show? Spotify, I think, does Discover Music, do similar things with music. So, you know, I think this is probably the basis of the screenshot that Esther showed us yesterday in the Mendeley world, where if you can track that level of individual behavior then you can open up a whole new realm of possibility of functionality for that user. But the paradox is that for most of us as publishers, we're not able to do that with the site technology and the access behavior that we currently have in place.
Netflix is a great example, I think. Yeah. Netflix is a fantastic example, I think, of the solution that we can work towards in our industry. Because you think about Netflix, and Netflix has very strong DRM. Netflix controls the point of use and of access of all of its content, and Netflix requires you to authenticate when you use it. So all the things that a lot of people say, you know, we don't want to have happen. But nobody complains about Netflix being too intrusive. Nobody complains about those aspects of Netflix because it provides so much value to its users. And so that it's a trade that people are absolutely willing to make, and to a large extent, they don't even think about it. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a key lesson to learn, is that if we tie in knowing things, engaging with our researchers and our customers and knowing things about them to improvements in the product and direct value that we can give them, I think it makes the whole idea of you know, causing them to log in or understanding their identity and understanding their behaviors, it makes that much more palatable to the end user, because it becomes at that point a fair trade. I think it's an issue if you ask people to authenticate or to log in or to tell you about themselves and you give them nothing in return that's directly related to that information. And that I think is related to a different mistake that some companies make, which is and not in publishing but in the wider world, of restricting the features of a product unless you give them something. And those restricted features are not connected to the information that they want from you. Because then you seem like you're extorting them for information, rather than it being, you know, directly connected, rather than having that direct bridge. And I think that's a valuable lesson that we can learn, and a way we can work towards a solution for this. And also, another piece of that is the security piece. You know, institutions are, as we talked about yesterday, and I think we went to great lengths through it, so there's no need for me to kind of go over this concern that institutions certainly should have, that when people are stealing credentials and, you know, and logging in from someplace in Kazakhstan into Yale's library, they're not logging into the library, they're logging into the institution, and they're hacking into the institution. That makes the institution vulnerable. So I think that if we do a good job of explaining the value of authentication, a good job of explaining the value of identity management, I think it can be perceived very positively.
Michael?
Can I bring up a potentially dire scenario or question? Maybe it's just a question, but since you asked me to mention something dire. But, you know, for the room, for a lot of publishers in the room, I think there is a concern around this promise of what technology offers and what the user could benefit from in terms of application of this technology. And I think it's around aggregation of content. So Netflix, to continue the analogy, is very successful. It has a lot to offer. It aggregates content from a lot of sources. There was a competitor, there still is, Hulu, which had a very slow start in life because it was the product of only one U.S. network, and they decided that they would go it alone. And only very recently have they managed to form content alliances and bring other providers into their platform to make it more attractive. So for publishers, I think the question becomes, to what extent, to be part of this sort of ecosystem of the future, do you have to be part of somebody else's mediating platform where this sort of recommendation layer, this targeting or individualization, personalization, customization will take place? And is the role of the content thereby commoditized in some regard? Or is the publisher disintermediated in that scenario? I think that is a concern for a lot of publishers who are used to interacting directly with their users, albeit anonymously, and perhaps particularly to society, publishers who have a direct connection with their members.
Heather Staines, about that point regarding aggregation and platforms.
Well, really, I was thinking if you're going to try to be useful to your users, you want to avoid, you know, doing it in a really clunky way. Because while they may not think that much about, you know, authenticating to get a Netflix, you know, I call it the sort of the traveling socks theory. You're looking at a pair of socks on a website or, you know, or anything, and it follows you around then from every website that you went to. And I just want to be like, you know, there should be a way to tell it. Shouldn't it know I already bought the socks? Or I should be able to say, I don't want those socks. So the danger of giving recommendations to your user is, you know, Amazon in the early days, you bought a coffee maker, do you want a coffee table? You know, so if you're going to go about trying to provide added value in exchange for your user's information, make sure you don't just flub it from the beginning, because that is something they definitely will notice.
Sam Bruinsma, this notion of sort of following the lead of the B2C world, the business to consumer world, and its implications for publishing, those examples that Heather raises brought us all a good chuckle. How do you feel about that issue?
Well, I think that user behavior of researchers and authors are being shaped in the real world and not only in their professional existence. And that's about reading, about using devices, etc. I want to go back to what you raised earlier. I made a note, if in hindsight there's something missing in our trends, it's in there, but very small. It's probably the role of the social sharing networks. I think we underestimated that when we discussed things in December. And they might be able to, of course, and they are able, to provide some of the services you described. And so that's an important lesson to us publishers.
All right. Well, Phil Jones, I want to switch to this notion of science as a social machine. Again, your background in science, I think, is important to this discussion. And you are seeing, I think, there at Digital Science, an evolution in how science is approached. And there's a phrase on our waves and currents here about the industrialization of research.
Yes.
Talk about that and its implications for publishing as well.
Well, I think that there has been everybody knows that research has become much more collaborative, right? Anybody who's ever edited a journal or read one can see that the author lists are getting longer and longer. And at Digital Science, we did some research. Jonathan Adams, in our consulting division, our head scientist, chief scientist, did some work in which they looked at the number of articles being published in a number of different countries, and then the number of articles being published which only had authors from that single country. And they found that the number of articles was rising significantly faster. So the percentage of entirely domestic papers is falling as a percentage of the total number. And what that speaks to is the fact that science has undergone a transition from what used to be a kind of a cottage industry model, where a single PI would write a grant, submit it, get some funding, or not, but hopefully get the funding, and then conduct the research, do the experiments, analyze it, write up the paper, send it off, and that's a package of science, if you like. So very much a cottage industry model. But today we have projects like GenBank, and we have things like the Large Hadron Collider and the Hubble Telescope and all the rest of it, where a large number of individual labs are all doing a small part of a bigger project. And it's much more collaborative for obvious reasons, and it's what is fundamentally driving a lot of this need for data sharing solutions and multiple outputs and collaborative networks and so on and so forth. So I think that it's a really good idea to just take a look at how the way in which science is conducted has changed, because that is, I think, very important business intelligence in terms of shaping the products to make sure that we're meeting those needs.
Right, and the challenge then is an infrastructure challenge,
yes.
It seemed to me.
Yes. Yeah, and I think to a large degree we are rising to that infrastructure challenge. I mean, there's obviously a lot more work to do, but we've created things like DOIs, we're looking at ORCIDs, there are institutional identifiers potentially emerging, and all of those pieces of infrastructure both enable us to support researchers in doing the work that they need to do, and also it enables us to understand the way in which they're working. So we can do things now, like we can look at grants, and we can look at data from... we do this at Digital Science with one of our products, Dimensions. We look at the data from grants, and we can do things like tracking tracking ideas and concepts as they're funded, and then kind of look at how long it takes for them to come out into the literature and things like that. And you could imagine you could use that to identify, and people do use it to identify things like emerging fields and emerging trends in the marketplace, whether that's geographically or demographically or in terms of convergence or divergence of fields, all sorts of very, very valuable information that allows us to better understand the way in which our end customers are actually working so that we can serve them better.
Right. And Michael Forster, that infrastructure isn't going to be simply an infrastructure around the article. We've been hearing earlier about the if not the disappearance of the article, the sort of the decline of attention around the article. And that's only because there's just so much more being published out there. We've mentioned data, but there are other artifacts as well, obviously video and so forth. Talk about that need within the infrastructure to be able to manage that kind of data as well as text data.
I think Phil just stated that very well, actually, that what we're seeing is the need for our processes to support a much greater diversity of artifacts. And I think that there's a huge amount of work for us to do as an industry remaining to allow that transfer in a lossless way from the creator of information in the research process to the consumer of it in whatever products we create, because the machine probably will be the new reader of information, but we certainly want for that machine then to be able to read information that was probably created by a machine in the original lab. So there needs to be some effort around standardization or identifiers or classification so that publishers are all doing that transmission in a similar way. You don't want 15 different railway gauges running within the scholarly communication world. Again, I think yesterday we saw Susan LeBeau from Linguamatics talking about pharma industry, data mining, and extracting meaning from text, much of which was probably originally present digitally before it went into the article. Those entities may have been probably encoded into barcodes on files that were ordered in the lab from Fisher or Bio-Rad anyway, but then they got turned into text strings by publishers who just put the whole thing through a mangle and squeezed out a lot of the information. So preservation of the original digital information in a machine-readable format is probably a big challenge for us as well.
Indeed. And Heather Staines, the collaboration that we've been hearing about and the extension from a single lab to a kind of a global network raises the notion of citizen science and crowdsourcing science and so forth, which are, I think, probably further out than some of these other trends. But can you talk about the potential there and the discussion at the Future Labs committee session around the place for citizen science in all of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think several folks here may have heard, presentations that have been done on, Galaxy Zoo and some of those projects, classification of galaxies. Also, there's been transcription projects similar to what Sam had referred to. I think it was recently one of the UK museums, they were transcribing letters and diaries from World War I soldiers, and the handwriting was so challenging that they opened it up. I think there was another, you know, large collaboration project around looking through receipts of government officials at some point to sort of try to detect, you know, corruption and that kind of thing. I mean, the degree to which you can get people to maybe move beyond that transcription or, you know, quick, you know, gamification, as in Galaxy Zoo, to do more science. I think that's a question, and that, you know, raises additional issues around peer review and the likes, and how that process is going to adapt to new types of research output. And, you know, I think, you know, again, come back to the point, everything's just connected to everything else. And you make a, you know, a ripple upstream, and then the publishers at the end of the day, you know, have to, not even the end of the day, the middle of the day, have to figure out, you know, how that's going to kind of play out. But I think there's so many interesting developments, the FoldIt project around proteins, and ways not just to get citizens involved in science, but also in education, the visualization tools again from yesterday, and how the children were so engaged by that process. You know, looking in the curriculum space as well for publishers, I think is going to be a great opportunity, and citizen science is one thing that may be fostered in that environment.
Indeed. Sam Bruinsma, I know that you were recently at the EU presidency meetings where open science was a really important topic of discussion. And tell us about the sort of the atmosphere in that room as far as publishers are concerned, and just what plans they're making to, you know, follow those various mandates.
Well, open science, of course, refers to open data and collaboration, but also, of course, about open access, which is actually a term I hardly heard the last couple of days. This is quite new. But it's all about open access, of course. And the sphere, I think, at the meeting was that the politicians now are aiming at a result that's probably not feasible. They are now aiming in Europe at a result to have everything open in 2020, so it should have been in here now. And but that's only 3 years from now, actually. So it's very interesting. Publishers were there. They made their case. But scientists were there as well. Librarians were there. But it was an agenda heavily driven by politicians.
All right. Finally, we want to look at the machine as the new reader. We've heard a lot about this before, and I guess the point is that humans can no longer do it all. And there was an interesting phrase that Aafke Smit brought up, Heather Staines, the peripheral brain. I think we all certainly recognize that. We have one in our pockets or in our backpacks. It really seems to me to be the great challenge for publishing right now is to recognize this abundance of information and try to deal with it in ways that will deliver value to the reader.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I've been interested in is linked data. I know we have linked open data on here, but, you know, linked data is critically important. And to make those leaps of discovery, of serendipity that you would make if you're using your actual brain and try to replicate that, you know, in the peripheral brain model, I think linked data is going to become increasingly important. And I've done a couple of sessions on this at ALA. A lot of the challenges around linked data are folks think you need to have a lot of data in order to get something useful out the other side. It has to be OCLC releasing, you know, 5 million records for people to work on, or the BBC, you know, using their data. But you can actually, you know, learn a lot from even small-scale linked data projects. And, you know, it ties into all the things, you know, from yesterday, all the different identifiers, the tagging, the natural language processing that, you know, enables that to happen. I mean, just an example that I always give is, you know, you could have libraries putting up information about collections that are, you know, writings of Mark Twain, for example. And then you can have that be connected to, well, how are those connected to people who, you know, you've got Mark Twain's novels, you've got plays, you've got books, you've got actors in those plays, actors in the movies, you've got linguistic analysis of things going on in the book. And all of that can be connected with linked data, enabling someone to kind of really, you know, go down a true path of discovery. And I sometimes feel like that we miss out on that by turning to our phones. I mean, I've heard this story before, so forgive me if you've heard it as well. A guy was sitting around the dinner table, and somehow it came up that his little boy said that they talked at school about the second longest snake in the world. And that led to lots of conversations. Well, what's the first longest snake in the world? Well, maybe it's the anaconda, or maybe it's the cobra. And, you know, they had this really great discussion for about 20 minutes. Fast forward a few years, second longest, what's the first longest? Oh, it's blank. Conversation moves on. You just really miss that richness of discussion that came about before. So be a little wistful about too much use of the peripheral brain.
Michael Forster, the idea of too much information and managing all of that, any solution, though, is going to have to be, just to Heather's point, kind of Google simple, right? It's got to have that immediacy of response. The serendipity and the dinner table discussion will have to wait for later.
Well, first, my new colleagues at IEEE will already know that I actually eschew the use of that device when we have those sorts of conversations, socially at any rate, because our own brains are quite good at things like that if given the practice. But I think the role of the machine has to be one where it is it's filtering, and it's producing, as one of the bubbles here says, answers, not search results. So even Google, I think Ifka actually said this, Google will give you pages and pages of hits, and the current state of the art is Google Scholar gives you pages of results, and then you just go through the first 50 collecting the PDFs, and then you go away and digest them. So the new state of the art, and 2020 is very close, I'm not sure it's going to be then, would be I ask a question. And my previous example, it's how do I synthesize this unknown compound? Another one is, what compression technique might I use for this communication challenge in electrical engineering, with a particular set of metadata around the conditions I'm using? And I get, and maybe the Watson example here is correct. I'm sorry, I wasn't in the room in December, but maybe this is what I'm channeling here, is that you want the technology to sift through all that big data, the article, unstructured textual information, and say, this is where the answer is contained to your question. And you then can only read a few snippets that will confirm that you have a valid source that you trust as a good scientist.
And Phil Jones, the opportunity here is for publishers to begin to develop those kinds of responses to questions, rather than leaving it to the researchers themselves to figure it out, or leaving it to other big players like Google.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely right. And what I think we need to take a very close look at is the kinds of end users who are consuming the content, and the fact that different types of end users have requirements for different types of content. And you can look at the way that they use stuff today to try to understand, what that content format should look like in the future. The example that I like is the way that particularly biologists, but most scientists, consume literature. Certainly most of the postdocs that I worked with when I was a postdoc, and most of the mid-career folks do this basic, same, similar kinds of approach, is that you look at the abstract and the title, perhaps, and you scan that to see if it's appropriate, and then you drill down to that figure or that single piece of information, and then you don't read the article, you look at that one thing, and then you follow a reference to the next thing, and then you follow a reference to the next thing, and then to the next thing, and then to the next thing. So you're actually reading vertically through the literature, not linearly at all. And part of that is facilitated by the fact that we have the internet and the ability to kind of quickly link between those, but it's partly the way that those researchers are consuming the information and the need that they have. So we should be looking at how do we create products like that that kind of mimic that behavior so that we can present that information more effectively. But at the same time, you look at a practitioner, not an active researcher, and they'll have a different need. they may well want to more linearly read because they want the thought process explained to them so that they can more easily apply it. Or it might be somebody who is a layman reading a piece of medical literature. You know, and in which case they'll want something that's lower level. They'll want something that's more encyclopedic, so that they can get a better understanding of the basics of a concept. So I think that what we're seeing, what we have today, is not quite a one size fits all in the article, because we've got review articles and short letters and things like that. But people are using the same thing in multiple different ways, and if we look at how they're using it, we can then tailor the products to better suit their needs.
Right. And Heather Staines, finally, before we go to questions from the audience then, so to that point about the ways that people are looking at it are different than we might have expected in the past, there are also these new consumers of the content that we've talked about briefly, the citizen scientists and so forth. And the point there is that they're disaffiliated. They're not with the usual customers and so forth. And so watching their habits, learning from them is going to be important. It gives us insight into some micro markets and so forth.
Yeah, so I've been spending a lot of time recently looking at developments in online education and doing a lot of updates for people on MOOCs, and waiting for somebody to yell out, like, hey, MOOC girl, which I hate that acronym. But we are finding, when we're talking about the courses that we work with at SIPEX, that there are a lot of people who, now they demographically, they have degrees. So, when you imagine, a layman or citizen scientist, that you're really talking about, educated people. Many of them do have even advanced degrees, and most of them are full-time employed. So the original notion of the consumer of the MOOC being a little kid in, Nepal that took 30 MOOCs and then got into Caltech, is really not how the picture is shaping up. But as they are not currently affiliated, these educated, employed folks with the university, in many cases, they don't have access to the content that they would once have had. They need to have a way to get it. And I hope, personally, it's not like a Sci-Hub, type solution. But, what kinds of new models can publishers work on to meet the needs, the lifelong learning, piece here, the adaptive learning. The notion that we want to shorten the time to degree, break degrees up into little manageable bite-sized pieces that folks can use, working towards, learning a new skill or getting a new promotion. And it's messy. It's not the way that all the systems are set up to work, based on the license. Even, the fantastic work that, publishers do through Research for Life, that's institutions in countries. Richard and I, had this conversation. It's not you are a person, in Uganda that wants this article. If you're at an institution in Uganda, you may have access to a lot of things because publishers, have kind of figured that out. But we're talking about yet one more layer removed. So being able to service people based on their location, based on certain affiliations that they might have. And we're all used to, when we make a hotel reservation, it'll ask you, do you have AAA? Are you AARP? Are you this? You could also take people through, sort of a cascade of options. Are you affiliated with an institution? Are you a member of a certain society? Are you located, in a certain physical place? And the way to, provide content in these new channels, in business models, it's going to make things a lot more complicated for us. But I do think that there's something to it, and it's worth exploration.
That kind of use is actually adding an extra layer to the two layers you already said about users of articles. And there's a fourth layer on the other side of the spectrum, which is where the article is merely metadata to the data set, as we discussed earlier.
And I think there's something that we're going to start seeing more and more of that's time to speak to this. Sorry to interrupt you, but it's just a thought that's occurred to me, so I have to say it before it goes. Is that right now, with data compliance, with terms of making data available, it's fair to say that the compliance rates haven't risen as fast as many people would have liked them. And part of the problem is that there's a really horrible workflow involved in it. And what happens is researchers they're taking data, and it's in whatever format it happens to be, and then they write up the paper, and then they ship it off, or the manuscript off, and hopefully it gets accepted. And then they think, well, that's done. Excellent. On to the next thing. And then somebody says, oh, by the way, You have to make this data available, and it has to be in this format. And then they have to go back through all of that old data, figure it out, add post hoc restructure it.
Look out for the leopard.
Yeah, look out for the leopard. Yeah, dodge the leopard, and then they have to post it wherever it's supposed to do. And that's a tremendous burden. So in many cases, they don't do it. So what you have to do is you have to integrate that data management right at the point where it's being created, a from-the-bench compliance-type solution. So we're going to see, I think, things in digital lab notebooks and integrating into some kind of repository aggregation system, you know, so that when you take data, when a researcher takes data, they can, you know, even tell the lab notebook who's funding it and where, and perhaps even where they're planning to send it or something, so that it can then tell them what they need to do at the point of taking the data. And then when we do that, I think we'll see compliance rates going up, and then, because it'll be easy, it'll be Google simple. And that'll enable us to build this infrastructure that we're talking about much more effectively. So sorry about that. I just kind of...
No, that's great, because, I mean, it's about an engagement. I'm sorry, Michael, but it's about an engagement with the researcher, with the author, even before they're submitting the piece.
Yeah, I mean, those persistent links and identifiers and everything effectively need to be pushed far further upstream in the publishing workflow, certainly as far as the peer review process. Because I think everyone I've talked to about peer review wants to actually be able to have access to those artifacts when they're doing peer review. So that seems like a no-brainer to me.
Well, a look at the future from our panelists, but we want to ask you to join them in looking ahead, ask any questions you have. We have a microphone there, and just raise your hand. Maybe you can let us know who you are and who the question would be for.
Yes, I'm Frank Rubino from MarkLogic, and I just wanted to take a quick poll of all the panelists. Some of the themes that are coming out over the last couple days, we are also emerging in this talk, like about being able to serve the authors better, personalize content, just, you know, break apart articles. What do you guys see as the immediate obstacle to achieving that vision?
What's standing in the way?
Should we go end to end or alphabetically?
Who wants to go first?
Phil, on the end, sure. Do you have an answer for that?
Okay. Oh, sorry. I think it's incentive structures. To be honest with you, that's the biggest roadblock. I think that. Publishers, a lot of academics and institutions, librarians and research managers are all involved in this conversation about, you know, let's make data more available, let's try to make it more, let's try to incentivize producing data and making data and all the rest of it, and opening up science. But I think that at the end of the day, each of those researchers needs to get their next job. They need to get their next grant. They need to get their tenure. You know, so they're looking in a very short to medium term on, you know, what's going to help them advance their career. It's incredibly competitive for them. So I think that the missing piece is somehow engaging and reaching out to very senior academics who are sitting on things like tenure committees, who are sitting on things like grant review panels, and kind of joining the dots between the mandates and the stuff that they should be hearing from their institutions and from things and from like the NIH and from, you know, the Wellcome Trust and so forth, and have them really integrate that into the way in which they assess research grants and they assess people for tenure and stuff like that. And that's a challenge. I see that as a pretty big challenge, because a lot of them are very conservative and they've been doing science for a long time, and they've been doing research and they've been academics for a long time. And so some of them can be a little bit set in their ways. I remember hearing a story from my wife who is an academic, and she was sitting on a grant review panel. And they were going through this grant, which was apparently very, very good. Excellent ideas, brilliant support, all the stuff that you're supposed to, review it for. And one of the crusty old men on the line said, "So how many Nature articles does this young man have?" You know, and it's just, and it's there's that barrier there that needs to be overcome, and I think that's the missing piece of engagement that we haven't done.
So, Phil Jones, it's who's standing in the way, Michael Forster. Is it a who or a what that's standing in the way?
I think I heard two very big components to the question. One around the ability for us as publishers or information service providers to facilitate the sorts of technological advantages of individualization. And, you know, I think that until we solve some of the issues that were being discussed in the debate around authentication and institutional login, proxies, etc., I think that is an impediment. But Phil's absolutely right, you know, to say that there has to be a quid pro quo. There has to be a user experience delight value exchange in order for people to feel like they didn't just get forced to give you private demographic information. So that's, a huge component there. We have to be ready to provide that value. The other question I think you asked was about the impediment or resistance to these trends around breaking up the article, componentizing information. And I think the answer there is really very simple. It's that our business, our industry, us as publishers, doesn't have a business model for a commercial transaction around those things. In fact, again, I think there is fear around feeling that others are doing that. The industry, our business is being disrupted. And someone else is going to profit from that componentization.
Heather Staines, briefly, what's standing in the way?
I think time and attention. You know, whenever you need someone, you require someone to do something, a lot of people aren't going to do it. How many people have half set up profiles and things you haven't forgotten? You know, if emails coming in updating you about services that you decided to try that, you know, linger on years after you expected that they would go. Just the engagement. I mean, we had a 5-minute conversation in a staff meeting the other day about if you were filling out a form requesting a demo, could we add a box that, in addition to your name and email, that actually was your like position, your role? And we ultimately said, they said, well, people won't fill it out. It's one more box. It's only 5 boxes. Mm-hmm. You know, first name, last name, email address. You know, I want a demo. Here, my institution. We decided not to add the box because we could just Google it. And I thought, well, that's just wrong. So time and attention would be my...
Well, time is short as well in this panel discussion. I'll leave you, Sam, with the last word on that. What's standing in the way?
Well, I think everything is already said there. I think it's about the perception of added value in the end. So people need to see why they are doing it, how it is helping them in their work, in their life, in their tenure track or whatever. So we need, if we want to promote these things, we need to make that very clear.
Yeah, I think that's the key. I think that's the take home.
All right. Well, if I may, another line from Julius Caesar comes to mind. The fault, dear Brutus, lies not in our stars, but in ourselves, that we are underlings. And I think what that really means is that we're not victims of fate. We are maybe masters of our own destinies or makers of our own misfortunes. And when it comes to the future, we have choices. And we should exercise them. I want to thank our panel, Sam Bruinsma, Heather Rowan Staines, Michael Forster, Phil Jones. My name's Chris Keneally. Thank you all.